I'm Kristen Meyershand, and this is the Opiongo Line, a podcast dedicated to the unique heritage and local culture of the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River Valleys here in Eastern Ontario, Canada. This coming week, many people in our area will be celebrating on May 3rd the fact that once upon a time their grandparents, or maybe even their great-grandparents, emigrated here in the second half of the 19th century. They came from a place then known as Prussia, but it was a place everybody before and afterwards knew as Poland. And those first few hundred emigrants came from not just any place in Poland, but from a very enterprising location called Kajubia. So in honor of those local grandparents and great-grandparents, we've brought together two very unique Polish Kashub voices. Actually three, but more on that later. They are voices with a unique story to tell that spans the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. In their own way, they are also very much the authentic voices of that curious Polish Kashubian culture that has very much helped to make the rest of us here in Canada what we are today. First up, we have a short autobiography as once told in 1990 by Annie Yantha. She was born near Wilno in 1914 and in 1942 married August Schulist. Annie passed away in her 96th year in 2010, but not before she made a lasting impression on all who were lucky enough to know her. Annie's story is as intriguing as it is instructive. She epitomizes those distinctive characteristics of not only her generation, but also her Polish Kashub culture. Her story was transcribed for a book, Madawaska Valley Memories, published in 1991, and it is still available in our local public library. It is read today by Kathy Chepesky, a member of the Opiongo Readers Theatre.
I was born on a farm at Pog Lake. There were 15 of us, but only 12 grew up. Three children died. My grandmother and grandfather lived with us. I don't remember my grandfather. I was 2 years and 2 months when he died. My mother said he used to carry me around because I was the first girl after five boys. She said he had a mustache and I used to pull his mustache. My grandmother was a very nice person. She had her own garden and she lived in a little house by herself. I used to go and visit her in the evenings and on Sunday. She would sit upstairs on a big step near the window and she would read there from the history of the saints. She used to dress in a big skirt and wear a starched apron over it and a cap with frills. She would make a pot of coffee, a little blue pot of coffee. She would put the lamp in the window so I could see through the dark. I could come over any time, just walk in. In Polish, we would call her babuska, but in English, it was grandma. I used to go there on Sunday mornings and she would sing. She would kneel when she sang. She sang in Polish hymns. They always used to say that I was like my grandmother, sort of kind. I don't know. I like to help if somebody's sick or needs help, and grandmother would always have time to talk about things. She was a very religious person. She came from Poland, and she talked about the old days there. It was hard to live in Poland then. You had to work for the rich to get some food. The rich controlled everything until there was a revolution there. Things got better after that. Not that good, but better. My mother was 7 years old when she and my grandmother came from Poland. It took them 4 to 6 weeks on the ship. My grandfather came first with my uncle, and then my grandmother came with my mother and my aunt. It was very hard when they came. It was all bush that you had to cut out, and you had to make your own hoe and everything to work with. My grandfather would walk to Renfrew to get groceries. Everything was cheap then. If he spent a dollar, he brought as much as you could carry. sugar and tea and coffee and some flour. The rest they grew, vegetables and potatoes and beef and pigs. Not very much at first, just starting, you know. But the neighbors would help each other. If anybody was sick, you would go there. I myself was only 10 years old when I had to go to the neighbors because they had a baby. I had to go there every day to work and only came home at night. I hated that. It was lots of work for a 10-year-old. We had to work, you know. We all went to school, but after school we had to work. Wash the dishes and peel potatoes. Help in the garden, milk cows, all those things. And the boys had to saw wood and chop wood. My younger sister used to do the cooking and I helped her. She wasn't as strong, so I did the washing and the scrubbing, and I would help her to get things ready. I worked hard. I wanted to do things right so that they would not get out of hand. But there would never be time. My mother did lots of sewing and spinning. It was a big family, so she sewed everything for us, even suits for the boys, for First Communion. My oldest sister died of spinal meningitis. She was 12. The neighbor's girl was sick, and my sister went to visit her, and when she came back, she got sick. They both died within a day of each other. That was very sad because she was already old enough to help. Then my other older sister died with quinsy of the throat. So that was very sad. She had a baby, 9 months old. My mother took him and we brought him up too. My mother still smiled and sang. At first it was hard, very hard, but when you have to, you get used to it. But you never forget, really. You never forget. Our neighbor had 7 children, one after another. She died when the youngest one was 2 months old. So then my mother helped to bring up those children. And my aunt died with a baby, so my mother helped raise those children too. They were all like our brothers and sisters, but they didn't move in with us. They just lived near us. They would go to school and come back to our place. I still remember the day my aunt died. I remember her casket with the little baby beside her. She was 39 years old. The doctor didn't come in time. She hemorrhaged to death. People would help each other then without taking money. Even my brothers went to the neighbors to help them cut grain and that. There was no talk that anybody would take money. It was all for nothing. At that time, people didn't have money to give away. They barely lived. In the 1930s and the Depression, nobody had money. We had a little money because my father kept the post office at our place. He would take the mail to Wilno every Saturday, take it and bring it. That was 10 miles each way. He left between 7 and 8 in the morning so the mail would get on the train that left from Wilno at 11. Then he would bring back the mail from the whole week. People came for their mail and they visited us, which was nice. Saturdays, they started coming around 3 o'clock. The rest would come on Sunday. He got about $20 a month for that. It was a little bit of money to look forward to. It wasn't much, but it was a help. In the winter, we went to church by cutter, but in the summer we walked. You would meet other people walking. It was really interesting, and a lot better than now. You knew everybody. Sometimes you were a little bit tired, but it was just once a week on Sunday. Mass was longer then. It would start at 10 and last till 12. We used to go after we had First Communion, 8 years old or so. You often had to stand. There wasn't many pews. Mostly you had to stand. Some people had bought pews, and so they had their own. The other people would stand in the back. The homily was long, longer than now. 2 hours, 2.5 hours sometimes. And it was different from now. The priest scolded people. You were supposed to be good. You listened. You did not understand the Latin, but you were there. The Mass was different. Now it's a lot better, now you understand it. I like school. I was good in school. I could spell well and read, and I was good in mathematics. I would have loved to have gone to school further. They wouldn't have had to push me like some do now. But then I had to stay home and help. Times weren't as easy as now. But maybe the depression was not as bad as it might be now, because we weren't used to anything good, so we just tried hard to survive. Now it would be harder because things are much more expensive for those who have no money. It must be so hard for people who have no work. I like to work. I like to clean. I cleaned the office of Dr. Chepesky for 33 years. I like to do things right. Whatever I do, I like to do it right. Grandmother was like that too. I remember she picked raspberries. She would put her glasses on and go through each raspberry before she cooked them. Lots of girls used to take the Wilno train to Ottawa and do housework. Somebody who was there before would find a job for you. Or you could go to the Rosary Hall that the sisters ran. People who wanted a maid left their names there. I worked in Ottawa every winter for 17 years. I was a little bit nervous before I went down, but a few of us went together. Usually, we got Thursday afternoon off, and every second Sunday, and then we would get together. We would go out to shop. There were places that you could sit down for a while. We could sit in Union Station, or we could go to church. We had to be back by 11. Thursday afternoon, they would give you off. You would prepare things for supper, and then around 2 o'clock, you could leave and have the whole afternoon off. You would go shopping, but just to look around. You didn't shop very much because the wages were small, $10, $12, $15, $20, $25 a month. But there were lots of places you could go and look. On Sunday, you could go for a ride on the streetcar and then go to benediction. Usually, you couldn't bring any visitor to where you worked, but sometimes you could. One place I worked, I could have one girl for supper every second Sunday. The first place I worked was very nice, but the little girl was very bold. You had to watch out. Children then, they were not so good. At another place, they had a 12-year-old boy, and he was cruel. If I was hanging out clothes, he would grab me around the neck for fun, or he would grab my letter, run away and read it. They were nice people. They weren't Catholic, but they made sure that I went to church. They gave me time to go to church on Sunday, even on Ash Wednesday. You didn't eat with them, you ate in the kitchen. It was better. Everybody liked it. The first place I worked, the wife's father lived with them. So the first thing in the morning would be to get him breakfast in bed at 7:30. Then you started the breakfast for the family, and afterwards the dishes had to be washed and the house dusted. Then every day was something else. Monday morning, washing. You didn't have a washing machine at that time. Tuesday was ironing. Wednesday, do the floors. Thursday afternoon, you got to go out. Friday, you baked something, usually a batch of cookies and a cake that would be for the whole week. On Saturday, you did the rest of the work. You had to work all the time. Maybe after noon, you had an hour or so, some days, to go lie down or write yourself a letter. In the afternoon, you changed into a different colored uniform. In the mornings, we had blue stripes. In the afternoon, we changed to black and white cuffs and a white collar and a little cap, like a nurse. You had to wash that every week. You did that on your spare time, too. Washed and starched and ironed the collar and sewed it back on. Then you would fix dinner and take it into the dining room, and then you would go to the kitchen and wait until they rang the bell for dessert. After dessert, they would leave and you would clean up, and they would go to the living room. They stayed in the living room or the family room upstairs, so you didn't talk much with them. I don't know if they wanted to talk much. Sometimes they'd ask something about your family, but not that much. It was everywhere like that. It was nice. It was interesting, and you learned a lot. How to organize yourself and how to budget, because they did not spend much money. They had company sometimes, but then the lady gave me $2 extra. And her father used to give me $2 a month when he got his pension. Sometimes they let us go for Christmas. Sometimes they didn't. One place I worked, there was an elderly lady, and she had a stroke. So then I didn't go for Christmas. But for the summer, I wanted to come back to the farm. I met my husband in 1937. I met him at his brother's wedding. I went back to Ottawa one more year, and the next year I got married. I got married at home. It was a pretty big wedding, maybe 150 people. My cousin came from Barry's Bay, and she was the head of it. She came for a week. It was very nice. She took care of everything. She made the wedding cake, and then she did all the baking. On the day of the wedding, she looked after everything. Weddings were longer then. When my sisters got married, it started the night before. If the wedding was Tuesday, it started Monday night. But when Father Woloski came to Wilno, he stopped that, which was good because it was too much work. We bought this house in September 1942, and we stayed here ever since. We added on to it in 1968, when my mother-in-law came to live with us. It is good if old people can be with their families, but it is pretty hard. I don't know if I want to impose myself on my children. It's too hard. My grandmother was 84 when she died. She was in bed with a stroke for 16 months. She didn't talk, just maybe a word or two that you could understand. She got sick October 5th, and she died the next February 12th. That was 16 months. She was all the time at home, and I helped to look after her. I would feed her and clean her up. My mother was sick too that summer, so I had to do the work. She was in her own house, but I would stay there at night with her. It was very hard. Now you would say you couldn't do it, but that time you had to do it. There was no other way. I was 16 when she died. It was sad, but we didn't talk about it. We were a big family, and one would probably laugh at another, so we just kept it inside. I guess nobody had much pity. At that time, everybody was satisfied with what they could have. Now, even if people have much, they seem to want more. They think they won't have enough. In the old days, nobody was afraid of how things would come to an end. You prayed for God to protect you, but you weren't afraid.
That was Kathy Chepesky reading from a short autobiography as told by Annie Shulist, née Yantha, and who, except for those 17 years away in Ottawa, spent the rest of her days here in the Upper Madawaska Valley. Next up, we are pleased to have Peter Glupczewski, who was born and raised here as well, and who has spent the past 11 years as the president of the Wilno Heritage Society and Polish Kashub Heritage Museum. Peter retired from that volunteer position last fall, but in the group's most recent newsletter, he wrote much, much more than the standard message of goodwill and goodbye. He wrote eloquently about his own very personal struggle of finding his true cultural identity, something that many Canadians know. You don't need to be a Polish cashew to understand the struggle.
At the September 2022 Wilno Heritage Society Annual General Meeting, my time as Society President ended. I did not accept renomination to the position I have held for the past 11 years. As I depart, I would like to take you on a bit of a personal journey of reflection, an exploration of identity, why I claim an inclusive heritage of Kashub and Pole. It is a journey through the eyes of my Kłopota-Głuszewski family. Growing up in Barry's Bay in the 1950s and 60s, one was acutely aware of the village's two predominant ethnicities of Irish and Polish. My family and surname made me the latter, but then there was also a distinction to be made within our Polish heritage. There were the Stary Kraj, Old Country, post-World War II Polish immigrants living mostly in southern Ontario and buying and building summer residences on lakefront properties, primarily on Kamieniskag and Wadsworth Lakes. We, descendants of Canada's first Polish settlers who arrived in the latter 1800s, were the others, the supposed Low Polish, the Kashubs. These descriptive slights, Stary Kraj and Low Polish, created an unfortunate rift between the two groups, one that has taken decades to acknowledge and heal. In the early 1960s, St. Hedwig Parish, under the direction of Father Zygmunt Lewandowski and the tutelage of Mrs. Mira Jaworska, formed a Polish dance youth group, to which my parents volunteered myself and three siblings. There were nearly 20 of us, mostly of Kashubian descent, ranging in age from the late single digits to early teens. We endlessly rehearsed several Polish regional folk dances to the point of becoming quite good. My personal highlight of those years were the costumes we had, especially the swords and the high leather boots. Mira was entirely aware of our cultural heritage and included both a dance and song connected with Kashubia and its people. By the end, we had about a dozen regional Polish folk and cultural dances and performed in several locales over a period of years. St. Hedwig and St. Mary Parish Hall, the televised MacBeady Show in Pembroke, the old dance hall at Halfway, and tours to Toronto and Hamilton, among others. On at least one occasion, several Canadian Polish youth groups joined us in a competition. We placed second, and Mira lamented that we should have won the day, except that the judges felt we were not Polish enough to win. Many years later, I would read the novel The Tin Drum by German Kashub author Günter Grass. The hero of the story is Kashubian, and Grass depicts a reality of the time that Kashubs were deemed to never be Polish enough to be Polish. I'll leave this topic for now. In 1973, my eldest brother John brought a greater Kashub awareness to our family. For the Museum of Man, John interviewed dozens of our local, mostly Kashub elders, speaking and singing in their native Kashub and Polish languages. He amassed 56 audio tapes traveling throughout the eastern Ontario villages of Wilno, Barry's Bay, Round Lake, and Killaloo. John's goal was to preserve oral memories of still living second and third generation descendants of our Kashub and Polish immigrant ancestors. In 1980, the National Museum of Man published some of his work in a book, Folk Music of Canada's Oldest Polish Community. In 2006, John would expand on his work, producing a 99-track CD of the same title. There are songs, dances, hymns, greetings, rhymes, and more. The CD is accompanied by a booklet written by John, which gives much insight into the meaning of each tract. During the mid-1970s, the University of Ottawa's Slavic Studies Department offered university credit courses in Barry's Bay in Polish literature and history. I was fortunate to take one of these courses in the summer of 1974. My mother was the local University of Ottawa liaison for these courses. The professor, Dr. Tadeusz Krakowski, would often come to our home to visit and enjoy a meal. He was keenly aware that he was seated at a Canadian Kashub table. In the 1970s, our family was beginning to connect with family in Poland. Brothers Ron and John both studied in Poland and met numerous family. Ron subsequently spent years compiling and charting a detailed Polish Kłopotek-Głowczewski family tree and a corresponding Canadian Kłopotek-Głowczewski family tree. Over the course of many years, we have personally met and shared meals with these not-so-distant cousins in Poland and in Canada. In the early 1980s, a local-born priest, Father Aloysius Rakowski, was telling our Canadian Kashub story. In the weekly Barry's Bay newspaper this week, Father Al presented several interesting and detailed heritage articles. For anyone paying attention, our Polish Kashub identity was being revealed. In the history of Europe, the Kłopotek-Głowczewski family is an old and well-recognized Kashubian family who held several estates in Pomerania, including the village of estate of Głowczewice. They were nobles, whose family coat of arms depicts a leaping silver half-salmon on a royal red shield. As nobles, family members participated in the election of Polish kings, and it is recorded that Stanley from Pomerania, known as Głowczewski, participated in the election of the Polish king Władysław IV in 1632. Members of the family are listed in historical documents as Kashubian participants in the Battle of Vienna in 1683, serving under King Jan III Sobieski of Poland. My first visit to Kashubi in Poland was in 2010. This trip would take me even further on my journey to discover the place of the Kłopotek-Głowczewski family in Poland's history. In the village of Lesno, we encountered a plaque on the local post office. Our friend and guide Stan Freimark translated. Jan Kłopotek-Głowczewski, mayor of the district of Lesno, was killed defending the socialist government by bandits from Lupaska group on September 24, 1946. Always be remembered. The Lupaska were part of the Polish and Kashubian underground army. They fought the Nazis during World War II and then the Soviet liberators. The plaque implies that Jan Kłopotek-Głowczewski was a Soviet accomplice who was killed by his own countrymen. This is not the truth. A couple of months later, my brother Michael met Stan's father, who immediately told him that it was the Soviets who had killed Jan because he would not cooperate, and the Soviets placed the plaque as part of their propaganda. We visited the parish church in Szronagacy, the parish where my paternal grandfather John was baptized in 1898. Just inside the entrance, there is a large plaque engraved with the names of parishioners killed by the Nazis. There are three Głowczewski brothers on that list. Bronisław, November 1943, Ildefons, March 1944, and Jan, February 1944. They are my cousins. In the small village of Głowczewice, I had the pleasure of meeting Maria Kłopotek-Głowczewska. She has since passed away and was the last person of her family surname to live in the village. She survived the Nazi Stutthof concentration camp at 11 years of age. She showed us her arm with her prisoner number. Her younger sister also survived the camp, but died from illness just weeks after being freed. In Warsaw, we spent several hours visiting the Warsaw Uprising Museum. There we purchased an English version of Abandoned Heroes of the Warsaw Uprising. There are three very young Home Army soldiers depicted on the front cover of the book. The photo was taken in August 1944. The young soldier in the middle is Corporal Andrzej Głowczewski. In 2018, I visited the impressive new World War II Museum in Gdańsk, Poland, and then Westerplatte, the site of the First Battle of World War II. I also visited the Polish Post Office Museum in Gdańsk and several countryside monuments to Kashubian resistors whom the Nazis murdered and buried in the woods. A week earlier, we had spent a solemn day at Auschwitz-Birkenau. Among the many prisoner lists, we recognized Kashub surnames familiar to those of Renfrew County. Another interesting book has come my way. The Accidental Immigrant is the memoirs of Jerzy Głowczewski. His grandparents were from Kashubi. The book begins with the outset of the Second World War. He escaped from Nazi-occupied Poland, joined the Polish army in the Middle East, fought in North Africa, and flew as a fighter pilot with the No. 308 City of Krakow Polish Squadron in the Battle of Britain. After the war, he was an architect engaged in the epic reconstruction of Warsaw which had been destroyed by the Nazis. In 2018, my wife and I were walking around Warsaw visiting historic monuments. At the monument of the World War II Battle of Monte Cassino, we found Jerzy's name among those who had sponsored its construction. These facts and stories all come together for me when I am challenged as to being Kashub or Pole. I am both. Again and again throughout history, our Kashubian family, the Kłopotek-Wieszczeski, have fought and died for Poland and its Catholic faith. One cannot dismiss centuries of shared history, and one cannot subscribe to the never Polish enough to be Polish belief. As Father Al Rakowski infers by the title of his life work, The Saga of the Kashub People in Poland, Canada, and the USA, the Kashubs are a people. They are one of the more than a dozen West Slavic tribes that make up the mosaic of Poland. Kashubs have made a memorable contribution to the history and culture of Poland and Europe, with a global diaspora now spanning almost every continent. The Kashubian language, one that was once called Low Polish, is now recognized as a distinct language in Poland. As president of the Wilno Heritage Society, I have worked toward and encouraging and facilitating a mutual respect between Kashubs and Poles. I engaged in many conversations with ambassadors and embassy officials, emphasizing the importance of our local heritage story, our language and traditions. I worked in concert with the leadership of the Polish-Canadian Congress to promote the awareness of Kashubs as Canada's first Polish settlers. I organized three community events with guest speakers from Poland on topics pertaining to Kashubian language and awareness. With the assistance of the Embassy of Poland, the Polish Heritage Foundation of Ottawa, and our municipality, I brought the feature film Kammerdiener to us. It is a stunningly beautiful, historically based film telling the story of Kashubia during the tumultuous years 1900 to 1945. It is a story of our Kashubian families who stayed behind. It is my belief that throughout the decade and more of my tenure in presidency, I remain true to our heritage, and I leave the executive of the Wilno Heritage Society with one hope, that the Wilno Heritage Society remain both Kashubian and Polish. This is who our ancestors were. This is who we are. Bóg zapłać, Peter Glowczewski.
It's a remarkable thing to know indeed who we are, and we want to thank Peter Glowczewski and Annie Shulist for letting the rest of us see just how unique our local heritage and culture truly is, up close and personal. I'm Kristen Marchand, and for Kathy Chepesky and our producer Barry Conway, we'd like to wish all of you with roots in the Polish Kashub community here or back in Europe to enjoy, especially this week, being... well, you. Good day, and God bless.